certain Pirkei Avot that if a person is learning Torah and they stop learning and they say Ma Noya Ilon Zeh, how beautiful is the tree? Harei Zeh Mischayev Benafshei, they're Chayev Misa, because they stopped their learning to talk about how beautiful it is. So L'chayev would not be proper to talk about how beautiful it is, but there's a Hasidic interpretation that says that the reason the person is Chayev Misa is because they regard appreciating the beauty of nature as an interruption from their Avodas Hashem, meaning they're mafsik. But if you regard the appreciation as part of being grateful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then for Kerek, it's not Mischayev B'Nafsho, it becomes a positive thing. So in that light, we're very fortunate in the middle of the winter to have such nice weather, and Mishta Hashem should give us HaKaras HaTayiv to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for giving us a very comfortable environment. But be it as it may, we're still talking about the Inyanim of Matan Torah, and I also want to connect a little bit to Purim and again to the Yom Tov of the Maral, interspersed with other Makshavas. That is, there's a Gemara in Masechet Shabbos that says that a certain Galilean, a person from Galil, said to Rav Yaisi, Baruch Rachamana, blessed is HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Yahiv one that gave us a Raisa Talisai, that means a threefold Torah. That's Torah, Nevi'im, Ksuvim. Biyarcha Talisai, in the third month. That's Nisan, Iyar, Sivan. After 3 days of separation, that's the Shlosha Shimei Hagbala, to a threefold nation. That's Kohanim, Nevi'im, Yisrael. Now, what this means is, many, many aspects of Matan Torah are connected to the number three. But the Gemara doesn't tell us why. What is the chashivas of the number three, right? What is the significance of the number three? So the Maral explains threefold Torah, threefold nation, in the third month, counting from Nisan, after 3 days of preparation. So the Maral explains the following. The Maral explains that every number has a certain symbolism, right? Numbers have certain meanings. So three is the shape of a triangle. You have two points at the extremities of a line, and then the two points meet at the apex, at the top of a triangle. So the Maral explains, therefore, that two represents the notion of opposites that are moving in a different direction. Two points on a line. One is going that way, one is going that way. Three is when the opposites become harmonized. They meet. They become integrated. Right? We talk about thesis and antithesis, which is antithesis, and synthesis. That's when opposites become harmonized. What is the pshat? Yep.
Where does he talk about numbers in general, Maral?
Where does the Maral talk about numbers? I mean, what sefer?
No.
He talks about it all over the place. In other words, in every sefer of the Maral, he talks about numbers. But this particular explanation is found in the Chidushei Agada. This is a Gemara Masechet Shabbos, Pei Hei, and the Maral. But the Maral's idea of numbers is something that he talks about in many, many of his svarim. And he says the following, therefore. A human being is really a bundle of many contradictions. On one level, we are physical. We are gashmi. We have to eat. We have to sleep. We have physical needs, physical drives. We could not survive unless we, as it were, accommodate those physical taivas, those physical lusts that are within us. On the other hand, the human being is primarily B'Tselem Elokim, in the image of Hashem. There is the divine soul. And the divine soul does not get pleasure from physicality and materialism. Materialism takes us away from connecting with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, our ruach, our neshama, only gets its nourishment from Torah, tefillah, masim tovim, devekus, attachment to Hashem. And within the human being, we have a constant struggle. We can call it the Yetzer Hara versus the Yetzer Tov, but we can also call it the struggle of the body against the spirit. A mushal that's often given, they often give us the horse and the rider analogy, that our body is like the horse that we take where we want it to take, but it has to be controlled by the rider. The writer is the neshama, the mind and the heart. Now, without a Torah, the only way we would serve God is by denying our physical selves. So for example, like the Christians, they say that in order to be pious, you have to be celibate, meaning you don't marry. You have to be poor, take a vow of poverty. Officially, a priest, for example, is not allowed to own anything, although the monastery can own things, VCR and everything else. But poverty and chastity are part of the commitments, meaning to say that without Torah, there will be an irreconcilable conflict between the body and the spirit. But Torah teaches us that we're able to take even the physical matter of this world and use it to act for HaKadosh Baruch Hu's avodah. And that's why so many of the mitzvahs are physical mitzvahs. Now, a person might say, for example, if the main purpose of eating matzah on Pesach is to remember Yetzias Mitzrayim, why do I have to eat matzah? Let me think about Yetzias Mitzrayim. And what if I'm so tired Pesach night that I could make a much better Seder the next day? Person makes a cheshbon. If the ikar idea of a Seder is to think about Yetzias Mitzrayim, so let me make a Seder after Pesach. You know, I'll be much more rested after Pesach. The answer is no. Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu says, I don't want you to serve me only in spiritual ways. Spiritual ways would be focusing on your thoughts, your philosophies, your contemplation. Hashem says, I want you to serve me in physical ways, by eating and by drinking and by marrying and by working. Because the holy sight of Torah is that it gives us the capacity to bring holiness even into the physical. So instead of creating a conflict between spirituality and physicality, between ruchnius and gashmius, the Torah gives us a way to be makadesh, to spiritualize even the gashmius in our lives. And the Maral says that is the yesod of why Matan Torah is connected with the number 3. Because 3 represents the principle that reconciles the opposite forces in the world. The opposites are ruchnius and gashmius, 2 different things. Through the derech of the Torah, we can even bring the gashmius into our spiritual lives. Now this is a very, very important yisayit to keep in mind. You know, the Rambam writes in Hilchos Deos that if a person eats and they have in their mind that they're eating l'shem shamayim to get strength to serve Hashem, if a person works but they think when they're working their kavana is to do chesed for people or to earn money to support their families or to earn money so they'll be able to learn and give tzedakah, the Rambam says they are doing mitzvahs not only when they learn and give tzedakah, but they are doing mitzvahs while they're working, while they're sleeping, while they're eating, while children are having recess. The children take recess with the kavana that they want to recharge their batteries. So when they go back to learning, they'll do so with enthusiasm. Recess becomes a mitzvah. Of course, you have to be careful. Sometimes people like to be machmer and do mitzvahs more than the minimum shiur. So somebody might say, I want to be machmer and the mitzvah of recess, you know, to do more than my shiur. But I feel lucky. The Rambam says that becomes a mitzvah. Think about this. This might be a little mental exercise that we can go through. You have 2 people. Both people are frum. Both people are going to their jobs 9 o'clock in the morning. Both people are going to work 9 to 5. And both people will come home and then do mitzvahs and learn and whatever it is. But one person has a machshava before they go to work, that my kavana when I go to work is to try to create a kiddush Hashem in terms of how I relate to other people, and to earn a parnasa so I can support my family and to be able to give tzedakah. According to the Rambam, that one little thought at the beginning of the day turns the entire day into a mitzvah of serving Hashem. The other person who doesn't have that thought doesn't have that mitzvah. This could be with anything, you know. You're at home preparing for Shabbos, of course, right? That's why the old thing where a person said, the old minhag that many people have, L'chavet Shabbos Kodesh, before you eat. You know, sometimes you see that and you might think, yeah, a little pretentious. You know, it's just like the Gadol Hador. But the truth is, whether you should say it aloud or not, that's a cheshbon you have to make. But it certainly doesn't hurt to think those things, because that transforms everything you do. and elevates it. Even frustrations. Your child knocks a vase off the table. It smashes. At that moment, you have a decision to make. Should I get upset or should I not? It's very interesting. You know, we look at it as a decision because often we don't talk about it the way. Often we talk about it, you know, I can't help myself. In reality, it is a decision, although it's a decision that needs to be made. You have like a tenth of a second to make the decision. But you make the decision. And a person could have a thought that says, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given me a mitzvah now. And that mitzvah is for halachta bidrachav, to walk in his ways, to emulate his midos, to be erech apayim, to be patient. And I am now mechaveh to fulfill the mitzvah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has put in my situation. You could even be grateful that the vase is broken, because you know a person is grateful when they have opportunities for mitzvahs. But again, be sure that your children aren't going to be extra machmer to give you these mitzvahs. So that's the same, going to be the same problem. So the point is this. The point is that Torah gives us a mechanism by which every single activity in life creates the potential to be Mekadosh Shem Shamayim. That you don't get Kedusha by escaping the involvement in this world, but Kedusha arises by being involved in this world. That is the notion of being Mekadosh the Gashmias, and the Maral Yisrael is that is derived from the number three. Three is the notion of synthesis and harmony. We see as the same idea, although it's not the same three, but the notion of synthesis in the Avos. Avraham represents serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu through loving kindness. Yitzchak represents serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu through strictness and introspection and discipline. But Yaakov is the harmonization of loving kindness and strictness, and their harmonization is called Teferis, beauty and truth. Beauty, truth, Teferis, Anas, and Torah. Because you see, if one is over-involved in Chesed, that could be very destructive. That's why Avraham had a Yisrael. We know this as raising children, right? If you relate to your child totally with Midas HaChesed, without structure, without guidance, without discipline, the child will become wild and uncontrollable and will never learn how to live a proper life. So Chesed needs to be counterbalanced with a sense of Gevura, which is structure and discipline. We also know, however, that if there's too much Gevura in one's interaction, that results in rejection and disparagement. And certainly a child is not going to flourish well in an atmosphere of rejection and negativity. And that's why Yitzchak had an Esav. This is what the Sfarim said, that the extremity of Chesed produces one type of negative effect, the extremity of Gevura produces another type of negative effect. Yaakov Avinu is the apex of a triangle, combining the midos of Chesed and Gevura, and thus, with Yaakov Avinu, Chazal say, Mitaso Shleima, all of his children, although they had their problems, Mechiras Yosef, etc., but all of their children are part of the Shiftei Ka, because they come from the Mizug, the mixing together, the integration of the Midos of Chesed and the Midos of Gevura. Right? That's why, by the way, it's no accident that, you know, Pirkei Avos says, Al Shlosha Dvarim Ha'olam Omed, there are three pillars that the world stands on: Torah, divine service, Gemilas Chesedim. So it says, Avraham represents the Amud of Gemilas Chesed. Yitzchak, who was a Korban, represents the Amud of Avoda. But Yaakov represents the learning of Torah, because it's no accident. Because Torah itself, as the Maral says, is connected with three. Three is harmony, balance, and integration. So, this is on two levels. It's the harmony of the body versus the spirit. And it's the harmony of Chesed and Gevurah. Right? Because, for example, how do I know when to be kind and when to be strict? Right? How do I know? The answer is Torah gives me that guidance and hadracha as to how to combine rachamim and din. By the way, though, Chazal say very beautifully, particularly in the context of raising children, that, you know, the right side is always described as the side of kindness, And the left side is described as the side of strictness. So Chazal have the beautiful idea that the right hand should draw the child near, and the left hand should push the child away. What is that expression? Chazal were always talk about the right as being the stronger hand, so if you're a lefty, you just reverse it. The concept is, the strong thing you should do, the dominant thing you should do, should be one of kiruv. And the discipline should be the less dominant. The discipline should be done the weaker. It should be the weaker thing. In fact, a very prominent firm psychologist, she's written some books. Maybe you've maybe heard Sarah Hannah Radcliffe, a woman in Toronto. She's written books on marriage and parenting. She suggests, as a rule of thumb, this is an interesting thing, that 75% of parents' interactions with children should be positive. And there should not be more than 25% negative. Now, unfortunately, sometimes it happens under the stresses of life that if you were to carry around a tape recorder and record the interactions, we might actually have closer to a reversal of it, 75 negative. But if you think about it as adults, and even the unmarried people are adults and they know this, you know, if somebody said one negative thing to us in the course, one negative thing to us, you know, it might ruin our day. Gee, you know, somebody said that to me. What? How many negative things do kids, you know, often hear in the course of a day, you know? And we get affected by one. So it's a little bit of trying to put ourselves, as it were, in their shoes. And of course, but again, it's important to know that chesed is not the only thing. The chesed needs to be balanced with gevura. But the gevura does refer to discipline, structure, and guidance. It does not refer to rejection or even anger. In fact, one could argue, again, this is a high Madrega, and I'm not saying I'm on this Madrega, but one could actually say that when should a parent be angry at a child? Angry at a child. By anger, I mean the internal anger where you lose control. The short answer might be never. There is never a justification for anger, although there are many, many times a justification for discipline and even punishment. But you see, discipline and punishment is not the same as anger. Anger is losing control, and discipline is when you are exactly in control of what you need to do, and you determine the child needs to learn a lesson. Discipline is an appropriate thing, but it should not be discipline of anger. In fact, the Bessner Rebbe, who's now in Harnof, but he still comes to America sometimes, he used to mention, and this is some people don't like this story, but he used to mention that his father would hit him. His father was the first Bessner Rebbe. But his father would never hit him right after he did something bad. His father would always wait 24 hours. Why? Because he says, I don't want to hit you out of anger. I don't want to hit you because I'm upset. I want to hit you because I've decided this is the best thing for you to learn how to become a better person. So consequently, he would wait until his anger went away, you know, the feeling of rage, and then he would do discipline. An amazing thing. He would not allow himself to lash out, either verbally or even physically, because he was upset. Because when you lash out when you're upset, although we say we're doing it for our child, that's not always the case. We're doing it because we're upset. And one has to be careful of that. But one might even say, although it's a very strong way of talking, that it's a form of child abuse to vent one's anger out on one's child. No.
They did say, though, that sometimes you have to immediately give the consequences.
Right. This is the thing. This is why some psychologists actually don't like this story, because they actually say that a child, particularly a young child, who may not have a good sense of time, has no idea if something happens 24 hours later, they don't even know what on earth is going on. It's irrational to them, and they don't make any connection. So again, this particular, whether this is the right approach or not, you know, there needs to be perhaps some immediate consequence. But the idea that one does not lash out is a very, very important yourself. And that's the notion of anger. Okay, we're not talking, I'm just, anger is really a digression from our topic, but the truth is it's such an important inyan, the notion of trying to manage anger and rage, that, you know, it's almost one of those inyanim that whenever it comes up, it's worthwhile to talk about it a little bit. And that is the concept of always having a choice, always being able to decide from second to second how one is going to respond. That's what Malchus is. That's what it means to be. You know, it says, call Yisrael, the name Malachim. Every Jew, Jewish men, Jewish women, are kings and queens. What is a melech? A melech is somebody who makes the decisions. In fact, again, I may have said this to you, that in Sifrei Chassidus it says that melech is an abbreviation for moach, lev, and kelayos. Moach is the mind, lev is the emotion, and kelayos means kidneys, but it refers to passions. Meaning, in a melech, the mind rules over the emotions and the passions. You control them. But, on the other hand, if you let your emotions control you, what's the opposite of melech? Kalem. Kalayos, lev, moach. Kalem means destroy them. A destroyed person is when the kalayos rule over the moach. A melech is when the moach rules over them. Right? So the idea of choice is something we always have to have. I think I mentioned that there were Balei Musar, I think the altar of Kelim, who used to have a red jacket. It was called his anger jacket. So whenever he was makabel on himself, that he would never express his temper till he went to the closet and put on his jacket. So if he had to wear a red jacket, see what he's doing? He didn't say, I'll never get angry. To say, I'll never get angry, that might be too hard to keep. So instead he says, I will not allow myself to express anger till I go to the closet and put on a coat. But you understand, the way anger comes and goes a little bit, by the time you put on the coat, you know, the rage dissipates, right? Those are little tricks that one does, but those tricks can often help a person get over things. In fact, just like Lashon Hara, if a person were to say, I will never speak Lashon Hara the rest of my life, what's going to happen to them is, as soon as they make that promise, they're going to be thinking in their mind, the Yetzer will come to them and say, the rest of your life? You mean 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, 50 years, never again? And what's going to happen is you'll have an uncontrollable desire to speak Lashon Hara right then, because you'll say to yourself, how can I go through my whole life never again? But if a person says, I'm not going to speak Lashon Hara for the next half an hour, after that, maybe I'll do it. So a half an hour I can hold out, right? You see, these are tricks. These are psychological tricks. And this is called in Kabbalah the notion of giving a shochad l'satan. You bribe the satan. You give the satan the impression that you're willing to go along with his game and he leaves you alone. Right? If you kind of say, I'm not going to go along, then he'll attack you even much more strongly. The Zohar gives the mashal that, let's assume that you want to go to a certain place and there's a wild, vicious dog that's going to attack you. So in order to get the dog off your back, you throw the dog a piece of meat. In fact, robbers do this. Burglars actually carry a steak, a raw steak with them. So if this Doberman or pit bull is going to attack them, they throw him a steak and the dog goes and eats the steak and they get a few minutes to get out of there. So that's called a shochet. You give a bribe to the satan by not frontally attacking the evil, but by, you know, giving yourself limited goals, limited times. Okay, but be it as it may, this is the yesod of three. Three is the notion of harmonization and integration between opposite forces, chesed and gevura, between ruchnius and gashmius, and this is what Torah gives us.
Can you look at also like men and women and Torah?
Yeah, I think that's yet another example, because we have in the world kochos of male and female, which to some degree would function in opposite directions. Torah, by giving us a framework and a structure, allows for the creation of ish v'isha to be one. You know, that's very good. In other words, the notion of the contradictions in the world are ultimately resolvable by this notion of integration. And this brings me to, I thought the Maharal says, by ish and isha, and again, I may have said this, I apologize, I don't remember where I say things in different places, but you know the Gemara in Yevamos that says that Ish and Isha, so the Ish has a Yud in his name and a woman has a Hay in the name, that spells Yud and Hay, which is God's name, right? So when God is in their marriage, when Hashem is with them, the Yud and the Hay, we have Ish and Isha living together. If you take HaKadosh Baruch Hu out of their lives, take out the Yud and the Hay, you get Eish. Eish is fire, meaning each person becomes selfish and egotistical and concerned only for themselves. So they'll be like a fire of machlokas, a fire of hatred, a fire of selfishness in which each one will destroy the other and destroy themselves. Right? So this is a famous Gemara in Maseches Yevamos. But the Maral takes the Gemara a little further. Why does the man get the yud and the woman get the hay? Like, that's the thing. Why does the yud and hay is God's name, but why does the man get the yud? So here the Maral says that the Gemara says in Maseches Menachos that the letter yud was the letter by which Hashem created Olam Haba. Hashem created Olam Haba with the letter yud. The force of the letter yud, the spiritual force, created Olam Haba. Why is Olam Haba mechuvan keneged the letter yud? Because yud, of all the letters, is the smallest letter. Yud represents that which does not have any spatial dimension. Does not, I mean, all letters take up some space, but as letters go, this is the least bounded by space. It represents the absence of materiality. It represents pure ruchnius. And yud is therefore the kayach of ruchnius. Olam Haba. Hey, the Maral says, well, the Gemara says, hey is olam hazeh. The Gemara says that, but the Maral explains, why is hey olam hazeh? Hey is a combination of two letters. It's a dalet. Dalet represents materiality, because we talk about the four directions, north, south, east, west, of matter. We talk about four dimensions. There is length, width, height, and time. Matter exists in time. Time is called the fourth dimension. So four is complete gashmius. And by the way, four also represents complete dissension, in a sense. Because unlike three, where the two opposites meet at an apex, when you have four sides, every side is going off on its own. And that's because in a world of physicality, there's going to be machlokes and dissension. So Dalet is physicality, but the other part of the hay is a yud. He looks at the foot of the hay as a yud. Yud, we already said, is Olam Haba, that's spirituality. So what is the letter hay? Hay is the ability to bring yud into dalet. The ability to bring ruchnius into gashmius. Yud is pure ruchnius. Hey is bringing ruchnius into gashmius. You see, you're bringing the yud into the dalet. So the Maral says, again, it's very relevant for women to know, that a man will often be corrupted by his involvement in the physical world. Might be prone to jealousy, to envy, to acquisition, to possessiveness. And therefore, a man's kesher to HaKadosh Baruch Hu is primarily by a certain degree of disengagement with the gashmius. That's why men have yeshivos, have kolelin, have minyanim that they go to regularly, because those are environments where they kind of withdraw from daily life in order to have that yud, that pure oxygen that connects them with the Ribbono Shel Olam. A woman's koach is very different. A woman's koach is to be involved in dalet, to be involved in physicality, whether it be cooking, cleaning, taking care of children. Again, we're not talking about every single person, but this is a general tendency, that they have a capacity to bring Kedusha even to that physical world. And therefore, in a sense, it's a higher level, because the man's Kedusha involves a certain element of escapism, and the woman's Kedusha can exist within the confines of a bias. But it's very interesting that Yud is double the value of Hay, right? Yud is 10, and Hay is 5. And what that suggests is the following. A Kedusha that is separated from Gashmius is on some levels a more intense, more exciting, more immediately uplifting spiritual experience. Meaning to say, to sit in contemplation of the wonders of Hashem's Torah might give a person a much bigger high than doing a carpool. And that's why the Yud is numerically higher than the Hay. Because bringing the yud into the dalet means it's less intense, it's less focused, there's more distractions, there are more nisyonos. And that's why it's a hey. But at the same time, that is the whole purpose of the universe. The whole purpose of the universe is, as the Baal HaTanya quotes a Medrash, that Hashem wanted to have a dira, Hashem wanted a dwelling place in this lower world. Because if the idea of Kedusha is the escapism of pure Ruchnius, then why create a Gashmius world at all? Let the Neshama just remain in Shemayim. But Hashem wanted there to be a Hey. Hashem wanted there to have the Yud not just exist as a Yud, but to have the Yud enter the Dalet and make it a Hey. So there's a cost. It's less intense. Right? You're not always going to feel so excited and on a high. But it's precisely that day-to-day struggle that one goes through that is the ultimate Kedusha that is created. And that's why there's a remnant to this actually in the Abbas themselves. If you remember, Avram Avinu was first called Avram, without the hay, and Sarah was called Sarai, with the yud. But after Bris Mila, Avraham got a hay, and the hay of Sarai, or the yud of Sarai, was replaced with the hay. So there are midrashim that say that the way HaKadosh Baruch Hu did this was, he took the yud of Sarai, and he divided it in two. Right, a yud divided by two, or two hays. So Avraham, it all came from Sarah. Abraham got a hay, and Sarah was left with the hay out of Sarai. So it's brought down that some Sfarim want to learn with this Maral that before the Shinui Hashem, even Sarai's Ikar Avoda was kind of escaping the physical world. But the Shinui Hashem gives a new mission that both Abraham and Sarah have to bring a Yud into a Dalet. And it came after Bris Mila in particular, because Bris Mila is a symbol of sanctifying the physical part of the body. That's why you find that the Shinui Hashem of Avraham Avinu and Sarah came after the mitzvah of circumcision, because one of the ramazim of circumcision is the capacity to be Mekadesh, even the physical part of our existence, the most physical and even involuntary, animalistic part of our being. Okay, so this is what the Maral says on the Inyan of Matan Torah, and the Yud and the Hey. And this idea is borne out, by the way, by many Mamori Chazal about Shavuos, just to mention some of them. There's a Maimor Chazal that says that, you know, there's a Machlokas, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yoshua. How does one observe Yom Tov? Because one Pasuk says Yom Tov should be for Hashem, and one Pasuk says Yom Tov should be Lochem, for you. So what is it? Do I spend Yom Tov davening and learning? Or do I spend Yom Tov eating and drinking? What is the proper way of observing Yom Tov? So there's an interesting machlokas. Rabbi Eliezer says, this is kind of strange, he says, you got a choice. You don't pass me like him. You can either spend the whole day eating and drinking and having a good time, making it, in other words, totally for you, or you can devote it totally to Hashem, learning and davening and saying Tehillim, and not even eating if you want. In other words, he reconciled the psukim by saying, we have a choice of either totally for Hashem, or totally for us. A little strange. I mean, imagine what he's saying. Yom Tov, you don't have to learn, don't have to daven, just enjoy. Rabbi Yoshua says, however, differently. Rabbi Yoshua reconciles the pasuk the way we reconcile the pasuk, that you have to split the day. Some of Yom Tov must be given over to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Learning, davening, tehillim, you know, serving Hashem. And some of Yom Tov is given over to one's physical enjoyment of eating and the like. But then the Gemara says the following. This machlokas only applies to Pesach and Sukkot. But when it comes to Shavuot, even the opinion that says you have the option of making it totally for God, on Shavuos, you have to eat. You have to have a meal. You have to have blintzes. And the reason is, Yom Shenitna Bo Torah, it is the day that Torah was given. So, L'chora, when you read that Gemara, you almost expect it to say the opposite. One might have expected the day of Torah would be the day in which I should have the right to learn the whole day instead of eating. And yet the Gemara says no. The day of Torah is the day you gotta stop your meal I'm sorry, stop your learning to eat a meal. That's a non sequitur. The day the Torah was given is the day that I should stop my learning to eat a meal. Even though on Pesach I don't have to stop my learning to eat a meal, except for the Seder, according to this opinion. And on Sukkot I don't have to stop my meal. Remember, we don't pass like that, but like that opinion. But Shavuos, I got to stop my learning to eat a meal. So the answer is very simple. If Matan Torah, and I believe the Maral actually says this as well, if Matan Torah is to teach us that even the body can be harmonized with the spirit, then you have to carry that lesson into practice. You have to say, I'm going to show that by feeding my body L'Shem Shemayim. Meaning, if all you were to do is learn, or daven, you would in effect be saying that Torah is only serving Hashem on the spiritual realm, and not on the physical. But that's exactly the opposite of what Matan Torah is designed to teach us, and therefore you are mechuyev to stop your learning and make a meal. That's one thing the Gemara says. Now, in connection with this general thought, I wanted to tell you a word from Rav Tzedek of Lublin, Rav Tzedek HaKohen, where he says, very beautifully, that if you look at Matan Torah, and the Torah describes all sorts of things, thunder and lightning and all sorts of visual effects and the like, they even saw thunder. We don't even know what it means to see thunder, but they saw things that are normally only heard. So, and then they got the Aseres HaDibros. And after they got the Aseres HaDibros, then what happened was, they again saw all sorts of visions. So Rav Tzedek of Lublin points out that there's a minor difference between what they saw before Matan Torah and what they saw after Matan Torah. Before Matan Torah, it says what they saw was kolos ubrakim, thunder and lightning. Brakim are flashes of lightning. And then there was Matan Torah. After Matan Torah, it doesn't say anymore they saw thunder and lightning, but it says kolos v'lapidim, thunder and torches in the sky. So most of us read that and we think there's no nafkamina, it's the same thing. Rav Tzedek says, why before Matan Torah, what they see is brakim, thunder, lightning, and after Matan Torah they see torches. So Rav Tzedek says that the difference in what they physically visualized symbolizes a spiritual transformation in their neshamas, before Matan Torah and after Matan Torah, in how they approached Kedusha, in how they understood that one is to be an Oved Hashem, and what is the way that one achieves closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Kirov to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and Devekus to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that is, even before the Torah was given, human beings wanted to be close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, particularly Jews who are descended of Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. But without a Torah, the needs of the body and the needs of the spirit are going to be in contradiction. And the only way you could achieve Kedusha is by disengaging from the needs of the body, by taking a vow of chastity and celibacy and poverty and everything else. Rav Tzedek says, that type of Kedusha is compared to lightning. Because what is lightning? You have a brilliant flash of lightning. Brilliant. But then it disappears. And you're totally dark. Because after all, if your Kedusha depends on how little you need the world, eventually you're going to be dragged down. Eventually you have to eat. Eventually you have to sleep. Eventually you have to interact with somebody. But if your Kedusha is a separation Kedusha, you'll have moments of great light. But then you'll be plunged into total darkness. And then there'll be another light. And then there'll be another darkness. Up and down, up and down, up and down. There'll be no stability. There'll be no constancy. There'll be no ability to stay connected. Torah, by the number three, taught Klal Yisrael a chiddush, a new aspect of Avodas Hashem, although as I indicated, the others had it as well. And that is, you can serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu not by escaping the physical world, But you can serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu by confronting and dealing with the physical world. That type of Kedusha, Rav Tzadok says, is no longer a brilliant flash of lightning that plunges you into darkness. It is like a torch. Now a torch flickers, but it keeps on burning, meaning it doesn't go from light to dark. It gives you light, it gives you warmth, it gives you direction. I was thinking, you know, many of you have been in Eretz Israel, so you know when you're going up to Tzfat, you got those winding mountain paths. So imagine if it's a totally dark night, a rainy night, and you have this bus that's going across, and the only, and let's say the headlights don't work, right? Right, scary. The only illumination you have is the lightning storm, and every few minutes, there's a brilliant flash of light. You really would not be willing to navigate a tortuous mountain road by the light that you get from a sporadic lightning flash. It doesn't give you any guidance. If you had a torch, and you had to, you know, it would still be dangerous, but the torch does give you this illumination. So therefore the concept is the following. Kedusha before Matan Torah is a lightning flash. Kedusha after Matan Torah is a torch. Kedusha before Matan Torah is a yud. Kedusha after Matan Torah is a hey. Now Rav Tzadok points out, once again there's a certain tragedy here. Because the Kedusha that's not involved with Gashmias is like a lightning flash. It's brilliant. It's much brighter than a torch. It doesn't last. A torch is not as strong, but it's constant. And you'll find your way home. You'll find your way to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that way. And therefore, the same point the Maharal makes about the notion of Matan Torah that is connected with three, Rav Tzadok makes about the difference of thunder, of lightning rather, versus the torch. In this sense, there's an interesting Gemara. The Gemara actually says that, you know, non-Jews were allowed to bring korbanos to the Beis HaMikdash. If one was a goy, they could bring a korban to a Beis HaMikdash. But a non-Jew is only allowed to bring one type of korban. A non-Jew could bring a korban ola to the Beis HaMikdash. But a non-Jew could not bring a korban shlamim. Right, so those of you who learned Sefer Vayikra know the difference. A korban ola is a korban that is totally burnt on the Mizbeach, totally given to Hashem. A korban shlamim, which is called a peace offering, is a type of korban where part of the animal is sacrificed on the Mizbeach, part of the animal is eaten by the Kohen, who brings the sacrifice, and part of the animal is eaten by the Yisrael and his family who brought the animal. That's why it's called peace, because everybody is happy. Hashem gets something, the Kohen gets something, the Yisrael and his wife and children get something. So it's interesting. A Jew can bring either an Ola or a Shlamim, whatever you want to bring. A non-Jew is allowed to bring only an Ola, not a Shlamim. Why is that so? So I think the Mefarshim say that the Svar is like this. Ola goes totally to Hashem. There is no physical enjoyment in an Ola. That represents the person who serves Hashem by totally renouncing this world and not getting involved in materialism. Even a non-Jew could achieve Kedusha that way. I'm not saying that a priest does achieve Kedusha that way because he might be worshipping the wrong God. It might be a Avodah Zarah, but assuming a non-Jew wanted to have a holy relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the holiness would have to involve a certain amount of disengagement, meaning the people that say you have to be a hermit, you have to go up to a mountain, they might be right, insofar as non-Jews are concerned. The shlamim represents the notion of attaching yourself to Hashem even when you're physically eating and enjoying meat. That's a madrega that is only shayach for Matan Torah. That's a madrega that's only shayach for a Jew. A Jew can have avodas Hashem even in physical eating. The non-Jew has avodas Hashem primarily in renunciation. So in that sense, really, the position of Christianity that you achieve holiness by disengagement may have a certain validity as it applies to non-Jews. It is not the derech of Kedusha for a Jew. It might be a derech of Kedusha for a non-Jew. But again, as they say, we can't conclude anything because this only works if you're doing it to serve Hashem,
Not if you're doing it to serve Avodah Zarah or some other god. So you could do all sorts of renunciations, but if you're renouncing for an idol, that doesn't count as Avodas Hashem. Okay? In fact, the Al-Sheikh says as well, by a Nazir, when a person makes a vow not to drink wine, so at the end of his Naziris, he is mechuyev to bring a korba. Now, there's an interesting machlokas. Why does a Nazir have to bring a korban at the end of his Naziris? Rashi says, because becoming a Nazir was a chait. Why is it a chait to become a Nazir? Well, what is the sin in becoming a Nazir? So Rashi says, really, it's quoting the Gemara, that since a Nazir prohibits himself from drinking wine, and the Torah says, morally and halachically wrong to be stricter than the Torah itself. If the Torah says you could do it, who are you to say you want to be a bigger tzaddik than the Torah? So therefore it is a sin, according to Rashi, it is a sin to be a Nazir. Yes.
I just have a question.
Morally and halachically wrong to be stricter than the Torah itself. If the Torah says you could do it, who are you to say you want to be a bigger tzaddik than the Torah? So therefore it is a sin, according to Rashi, it is a sin to be a Nazir. Yeah.
I understand that, because some people, like, they have to be a Nazir during their lifetime, that's what Hashem said.
No, you're correct. So obviously we're not talking about the people that Hashem said have to be Nazir. As you know, Shimshon, his parents were commanded that Shimshon would be a Nazir, and Shmuel may have been a Nazir as well, but we're actually just talking about people who decided on their own to be a Nazir. To decide on your own is wrong, Rashi says, because you are depriving yourself of the pleasures that the Torah wanted you to have. This is Rashi's position. Now, the Ramban and the Ibn Ezra argue with Rashi. The Ramban and the Ibn Ezra say that if a person wants to be strict on himself, and a person wants to get away from alcohol because, let's say, they feel that when they drink, they're too wild or whatever it is, so they want to be a Nazir for a limited amount of time, not forever, but for 30 days or 60 days or whatever it is actually a good thing to do. And you know what the Ramban says? Listen, the Ramban says exactly the opposite. The reason the Nazir is a sinner is, after you reach the high madrega of being a Nazir, you now want to leave it? You now want to go back to regular life? That's the Aveira. The Aveira is not becoming the higher person. The Aveira is wanting to go back. Really fascinating machlokas. According to Rashi, the Aveira was becoming the Nazir. According to the Ramban, the Aveira is wanting to leave higher madregos once you've touched it. Very, very interesting. Of course, it could be there's no machlokas. It could be different types of people. Certain people shouldn't become Nazir, and certain people shouldn't leave it once they've reached it. But be it as it may, the Torah says the following lashon: after the Nazir brings his korban, the achar kein, afterwards, yishta ha-Nazir yayin. The Nazir is then permitted to drink wine. So the Al-Sheikh HaKadosh asks a very simple question. At the Al-Sheikh's question, what do you mean afterwards the Nazir drinks wine? After he brings a korban, he's not a Nazir anymore. That's why he's allowed to drink wine. So what does it mean afterwards the Nazir drinks wine? So the simple pshat would be, without the Al-Sheikh, is the person who was a Nazir is now allowed to drink wine because he's not a Nazir anymore. But it says the Nazir can drink wine. So the Al-Sheikh says the following. The Al-Sheikh says, after a person has experienced Naziris, in which they try to perfect their neshama, so even when they go back to drinking wine, they can still be holy. Meaning they shouldn't think they're holy only when they don't drink wine. But rather, this teaches us that even the drinking of the wine, one can still be on the spiritual level of the Nazir. Meaning that through tshuva, through introspection, through cheshbain hanefesh, you can be a nazir and still drink your wine. We don't mean, of course, a halachic nazir, but you can have the kedusha of the nazir and drink the wine. And that's a hard avodah, because once again, it is easier, perhaps, to be holy when you're not involved in material than to be kadosh if one is involved. But as I say, the opportunities are millions and millions of times a day. Every time we speak to our children or to another person with friendship and kindness, even if something upset us, we are bringing kedusha into the world. I mean, these decisions, these opportunities for kedusha, just, you know, there's no end to their number. Every minute, every second. And we have to know too that the kedusha that we add is not just, you know, my interaction with one person. It adds something to the world. It adds something to the universe. The universe is changed. Maybe in a small way, but as we keep on doing it, it gets changed more and more. The spirituality of the universe is changed by the interaction that we might have bein adam l'chaveru. It could be changed for good, it could be changed for bad. Right? One should recognize that there's no such thing as something being insignificant. There's no good that is so small that it doesn't count, and there is no bad that is so minor that it doesn't count. See? And of course there's no bad that is so great that you can't rectify it by tshuva. Okay, well, one has to remember the chashivas of everything that we do. I'm sorry, did someone have a hand?
Actually, two questions going back a little. If you have a Jewish person and a non-Jewish person...
Yeah, the other one's shame. Okay.
Who both renounce the physical world.
Right.
Are you saying that the non-Jewish person can achieve a higher kedusha going that route? Because the Jewish person is really not.
No, I was not exactly saying that. I was saying the opposite. I was saying if you have a Jew and a non-Jew who don't renounce this world, then the Jew can achieve higher kedusha than the good. Meaning to say, the path of getting involved in the world is a path that brings kedusha to a Jew. However, when the Jew renounces the world, he will not achieve the same kedusha that he would had he been involved in the world, but it still might be higher than the non-Jew could achieve. I mean, I wasn't saying that the non-Jew will be higher than the Jew, but I was saying that the non-Jew will be higher by separating than the non-Jew would be by not separating. With the Jew, it could be the opposite.
Okay.
That's all I was saying. I wasn't comparing Jew and non-Jew per se.
And my second question just goes back to the kind of a parenting issue. When you're trying to combine nurturing with firmness, certain children have more challenges than others.
Sure.
I find that to be so... you don't want to go one extreme or the other.
Mm-hmm.
You have to keep, you have to kind of constantly balance.
And
it's very, very difficult.
Well, you know, there's the thing like this. You know, the mayor of New York, if any of you are from New York, Rudolph Giuliani, has what is called a policy of zero tolerance. Zero tolerance means that for many years, in fact, Baltimore now has a machlokas, should they put it in. For many years, the idea was that New York is a place where there's so many murders and so many things, so why should police bother with jaywalking and little things? They're only going to concentrate on big things, right? That was the shita all those years, and the problem was that the big things weren't going away. So Giuliani was mechadesh this idea called zero tolerance, meaning to say, we're not going to let anything get away, on the theory that if you let little things like littering, jaywalking happen, that creates a certain atmosphere of hefkeris, and if there's atmospheres of hefkeris, that'll lead to the big things. So that's why in New York today, if you jaywalk, if you cross against light, you can get a ticket, and you can even be arrested. And indeed, what has happened is, in New York, the murder has gone down. Actually, streets that were, you know, no one would ever walk, now are very safe. However, I want to say that although Giuliani's Eitza has worked for New York City, the Balei Musar tell us that a zero tolerance policy is actually not appropriate for children. And there is a musag here, which is interesting. It's an interesting question. Why did it work in New York and it doesn't work for children? That's an interesting question. But it doesn't. And the reason is that a child, by definition, has not reached a full maturity where they are capable of perfect self-control. And therefore, it is wrong for a parent to insist on a perfect self-control, because if you do, the child's spirit gets broken, you're setting goals he's not able to meet, and he will just be frustrated, maybe even come to hate the parent. And therefore, part of what one does in chinuch is to be relatively selective. You have to select what battles you're going to fight. You have to identify ikarim are, you know, the fundamental principles, and fight for them hard. When I say fight, I don't mean confrontation, but work on them hard. But then you also have to relax a lot of things. A very simple example. You know, Shabbos meal is a good example. Sometimes people have a long meal, and they may have a lot of guests, and the conversation is not so interesting for children. No, they don't even know what the adults are talking about. But the parents are, you know, they may have a thing. You have to sit at the table until benching, something like that. And the truth of the matter is that, lav dafka, that one should be fairly, this is not my chiddush, I've seen Balabali Musa write this, that a child should not be expected to sit at a table when activities are going on that are not according to what the child will be interested in. That they say, let's compare it the other way. Imagine if you were an adult and all of your Shabbos guests are your children's friends. And you cannot talk. You have to kind of listen to their conversation. Now, it might be very interesting. A parent might learn a lot. It might be very, very revealing. But on the other hand, you know, a parent might get a little restless after a while, too. It may not be something the parent is interested in. Well, keep in mind that what a parent might feel when the kids are having their conversations is exactly what a kid might feel listening to the parent's conversation. And the kid may have it worse because younger children find it more difficult to sit still. So there is a concept that you have to be very, very gentle. Meaning, you have to identify what is ikar and what is tuffer. There are a lot of things that's tuffer. Sitting quietly at a Shabbos table is not necessarily that important, if it's going to mean they're going to hate Shabbos. On the other hand, things like not lying, not stealing, not being rude or hurtful to people, those are important things, right? So you push those things. You pick five things or whatever it is, that these are the things you're going to work on. And on everything else, you try to be positive and nurturing and free. You know. And as I say, Dr. Radcliffe suggests that you try to create a situation where 75% of the words you speak to your children are positive words. Now, keep in mind, that's not inconsistent with criticism. You can criticize in a positive way, too. It's not a contradiction. In other words, the 75% that has to be nice doesn't mean you have to say 75% of the time, oh, what you did is wonderful. Rather, even in the criticism, there's a way of saying it. You have to be very careful. Rav Volba writes, in fact, if any of you saw the Get the Jewish Observer, there's a whole, the last one is about the whole issue of troubled children, and the like. It's a big issue in Baltimore. It's a big issue. And
it's printed.
Really? But it's a big issue in Baltimore. In Eretz Yisrael, where I was last year, it's a very, very big big issue of what's going on with kids from religious homes who are, you know, not able to be in a yeshiva environment that much, and what do you do, etc. Some of them are on drugs even. Right, so it's a very, very big, difficult issue. But certainly, part of the idea, in fact, Rav Volba mentions that a man brought his son to meet him, and he told Rav Volba, my son doesn't talk, he's very shy. So it's true, the son didn't say anything, but Rav Volba eventually brought the son out. And it turned out that this was a son, I don't know how old he was, he seemed to be below bar mitzvah, who was never allowed to play at all. His father was a Rosh Yeshiva, and his father had the attitude that play is not for a Ben Torah, and therefore the kid had to learn every moment. And Rav Volba said this, one of the great Bali Musar. Rav Volba said, not only did the child hate his father, the child hated his father. The child hated Torah. You know, so it's very important that one understands the idea of cutting children slack, giving them a certain freedom. But on the other hand, some things there should be zero tolerance for. There should be zero tolerance for lying. That doesn't mean, you know, you beat them, but, you know, should be point. There should be zero tolerance for insulting people, hurting people. Because these are the mitos, the fundamental mitos that a religious Jew needs to be. be Makadosh Shem Shemayim. Right? Those are the things. So it seems that if you're very makbid, very particular about the important things, and the little things get by, there's more of a relaxed atmosphere, and you know, people grow, and they become who they're supposed to become. I mean, there's no guarantee. I mean, listen, there's no guarantee in life. That's very, very true. I think the Stipler said, if one wants to have, what does he say? He says, if one wants to have good children, so I think his formula is 50% tefillah and 50% shalom bais, between husband and wife. That's what he says. It's almost as if, it's a funny thing. He didn't even mention anything to do with the kids. He says, you want to have good kids? Shalom bais and tefillah. He didn't say, you know, and the kids will become good on their own almost. He said that. But you know, again, I think it's not meant to be taken totally literally. But I think it does mean the following. It does mean, though, the emphasis of shalom bais teaches us that sometimes the greatest chinuch for a child is not what the child is taught, but what the child sees. In other words, what the child sees is a bigger chinuch than what the child is directly taught. So shalom bais, or whatever, the way the parents behave. Right? So you sometimes see in shul, it's almost laughable, where parents might be talking and davening, and the kid is making noise, so they, you know, they stop their conversation. I've seen this. They stop their conversation. Like, don't talk during show. And then they go. Then they go back to what they're talking. You know, it makes no sense at all, but it is done. What lesson does the child take from that?
No.
Well, when I'm a kid, my father doesn't let me talk. But when I grow up, I'll have the same rights as Abba. You know, I'll be able to do the same thing. Yeah.
I mean, I was in a house that very much brought home the idea that we often don't teach our children what we think, even in, you know, our good intention way we're teaching them. One of the little boys came up to the Shabbos, and he was a year and a half, 2 years old, and he had his father's cell phone, and he was playing, and all the other guests were like, oh, put it down, it smokes, it smokes. You know, and my mother tried to, you know, get him to put the phone down, and he said that the Chazon Ish said, you know, to somebody, and obviously it wasn't a cell phone, it was something, and it was, the father was in Moksa, Shabbos, it's, yeah.
So
you think you're teaching him
to disobey his father. Right. Because clearly this year and a half, 2 year old child is not going to give up his toy,
right. And you're
going to
scream, and he's
right.
Not going to give it up. So you're
right.
Teaching him to disobey his
father. Yeah, and that's why there is a yisod of katan shehi gia l'chinah. This is a halachic category. A child is old enough to be educated, meaning to say, below a certain age, we're not supposed to. Now again, this will vary from mitzvah to mitzvah, but certain things are not supposed to be imposed on a child below a certain age, right? And that's the yisod. Yeah. So these are things to keep in mind, that this confrontation with the physical, family relationships, marriage, child raising, working, all of these are vehicles in which we can have kedusha as well, right? And this is the union of matan.
Did the others have a relationship to God through the physical?
Well, this is what I suggested before, is some say this is the remnants of Abraham and Sarah getting the hay. That they
when
know
it
Shemot.
Says that they kept the Torah,
yeah.
Does that mean that they were able to?
The Pashtus, you know, Abraham ate matzah. In other words, it isn't the intellectual Torah, it is the physical Torah itself. The Mepharshim even asked, how could Abraham serve the Malachim? It says butter, chema, and meat. They kept the laws of meat and milk, so that's why the pasuk says first they had the butter and bread, then they had the meat. You know, you can have milk and milk. You see that in the Mepharshim, we try to kind of always. In fact, they asked the kasha, how could Yaakov marry two sisters? You know, the Torah says even if polygamy is permitted, you can't marry two sisters. And the Mepharshim give many, many answers to that. Right? So you see that we want to understand this to refer to the actual mitzvahs themselves.
But Abraham's way to Hashem seems to be through the intellectual, rational, spiritual.
That's actually an interesting machlokas. You know, Avraham is considered to be the first great kirev worker, right? Avraham, the Rambam says, was makarev thousands and thousands of people to believe in Hashem. Now again, he didn't make them Jewish. There was no Judaism per se, but he brought people to the worship of Hashem. And the Rambam says that he had great masses of meetings in which he brought them to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is the reference to Es HaNefesh Asher Asu B'Charan, the souls that they made in Charan. As Rashi says, Avraham influenced the men and Sarah influenced the women. But the question becomes, you know, we're not given a transcript of Avraham's speeches. What was Avraham's approach? How was Avraham able to be mashpia on people? So really, there's a machlokes
effect. Even how he came to Hashem, yeah, in the first place, it wasn't through, like...
Torah.
Well, no, it wasn't through seeing the Shlemus as invisible. I mean, it was through contemplation...
No, that's correct. That's correct, because yeah, but that's very good, because the point is this. Initially, without a Torah, you're in a world which pulls you away from God. So you achieve your initial understanding of God by disengagement. You need the disengagement so the world doesn't drag you down. In that state of disengagement, you're then able to perceive deeper and higher spiritual realities. But upon achieving those deeper spiritual realities, he can then re-engage in the physical world. You're correct. In other words, if you start off in the world without that Torah, you would need that disengagement to be masik Torah, as the others did, but then you go back into the physical. But how Avraham himself reached others, that's a machlokas. Some say, the Rambam is mashma, that Avraham reached others by philosophical proofs. Kind of like the discovery seminars of Eishet Torah, you kind of prove there has to be a God because of A, B, and C. Others say Avraham reached people by the chesed that he showed them. Okay, you have the same Shaila and Kiruv today, right? There are two, well, you need both, but there are two kind of approaches. Some say you bring people to Torah by intellectually proving to them that the Torah is true. And others say you bring people to Torah by the warmth and openness that you show them and caring about them.
Like
that
opens them.
Huh?
Like Nami.
Right, yeah. Right, Nami and Russ. So...
maybe one works better for men and one works better for women.
Yes, it could very well be. Women are more open to that, but some say, you know, some things work for men and women, you know, different approaches. But be it as it may, there is such a machlokes by Avraham Avinu himself. Was Avraham Avinu's Iker Kirav the intellectual argument, which the Rambam says? What was the Iker Kir of the Chesed and the Hachnasas Orchim that he showed others? The short answer is Avraham's Talmud did both. But both. But the question is, what was the dominant way that he reached people? I'm sorry, did you have your hand up? You want to?
Oh, no, I'm just saying, no. When it was the
Right, right. That was the Chiddush of Matan Torah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the only question is, that's true, for Klal Yisrael. But if we say the Avais kept that Torah before it was given, did they have that ability to sanctify the physical? Or, since there was no Matan Torah yet, their Torah observance did not have that Kayach. In other words, that's the question of, how do you understand the observance of the Torah, al pi the Avais, right? That's the question. But it could be that the Avais, because they're called the Merkava of the Shechina, they're called the foundation of the Shechina, that they had that Kayach as well. Okay. All right, so that's one thing I wanted to say. Now, another thing I wanted to share with you just is a... I do have to announce... I don't even know. I believe that next Wednesday I will not be able to be here. But I'm not entirely sure yet. I'm just trying to think. I tell you what, I will call the Bina office. So be sure to check next Wednesday if I'll be here. Right? If I won't be here, I'll give them a call. Or either way, I'll give them a call either way. Okay, so... be sure to check, because I have to go out of town next Wednesday, but I'm not sure if it's before the class or after the class, right? So just want to put you on warning. But since I may not be here next Wednesday, and the Wednesday after that is Purim, is that right? I'm sorry, Purim is Monday night, Tuesday?
Yeah.
I see, so Wednesday is Shushan. Okay, but our next year will not be till after Purim, so let me tell you a short thought on Purim, just so you'll have something for Purim. You know, there's a Gemara that says that Chayav Adam Livsumei Beporya. A person must drink on Purim. This is said to be mainly for men, but to drink on Purim. Adalo Yada. Till they don't know the difference. Get so drunk that you don't know the difference between Orer Hamam, the phrase, cursed be Hamam, and Baruch Mordechai, blessed be Mordechai. So you got to get so drunk till you don't know the difference. And the Gemara then gives a story how Rabbah once invited Rav Zeira over to a Purim meal, and Rabbah got so shikker that he took a knife and he slit Rav Zeira's throat, and Rav Zeira was killed, and Rava was mispalel, and Hashem made a Tchiyas HaNesen, and Rav Zeira was revived. And the next year, when Rava invited Rav Zeira over, Rav Zeira said, "You know, I don't know if Hashem does miracles 2 years in a row. I want to decline the invitation." So you can't be Samech and amazed twice. Okay. By the way, it's brought down in one of the Svarim that every single rabbi that is mentioned in the Mishnah and the Gemara had a koach of Tchiyas HaMesim. Every single one that was mentioned had such a koach. But the Meiri actually
said, right?
In the Gemara. That means it's not universally agreed upon, but it is quoted in, I think, the Seder Hadiris, which is an old work on history. Now, the Meiri actually says that the reason why the Gemara brings the story is actually to tell you that you shouldn't drink. In other words, after telling you the halacha, it then tells you how dangerous it is. And it actually means one shouldn't do it. Right? Some learn that way. In fact, we know, I mean, needless to say, yeah, we do know that here, even in Baltimore, a few years ago, a boy was killed because he went out driving after he had drunk. So, you know, certainly one has to be very, very careful. But at least if one is within the confines of one's home, the halacha does say one should drink a little extra. But what is the inyan of not knowing the difference between Oror Haman and Baruch Mordechai? So the Ramah takes the fun out of it. The Ramah says, well, it means you should drink until you fall asleep. And when you fall asleep, you don't know the difference between Oror Haman and Baruch Mordechai. Others say, an interesting thing, if you add up the gematria of Oror Haman, so what does that add up to? Aleph is 1, 200, 201, 207, 407, and 5 is 412, 452. It's 502. Oror Haman is 502. If you add up Baruch Mordechai, it should add up to the same thing. Beis Reish is 202, and 6 is 208, and Chaf is 228. And Mordechai is 40, that's 268, that's 468, 472, 492, and 10 is 502. So Oror Haman and Baruch Mordechai have the same gematria. So it means you should get so drunk that you're not able to add up numbers well. So at that point, that's a mild intoxication. But still, it's very difficult. Why do you chap on Baruch Mordechai Oror Haman? So there's a pshat that says the following. The Gemara says in Maseches Megillah that Gadol Hasaras HaTabas, when Ahasuerus took off his ring and he gave it to Haman, that was giving Haman the authority to kill the Jewish people, the removal of that ring did more for HaKadosh, for Klal Yisrael, than the 48 Nevi'im and the 7 Nevi'os that gave us Nevuah. Why? Because 48 Nevi'im and 7 Nevi'os kept on telling the Jewish people, do tshuva, do tshuva, do tshuva, do tshuva, and it fell on deaf ears. And nobody changed. But what happened because of the removal of that ring? All of Klal Yisrael did tshuva to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. All of Klal Yisrael accepted the Torah out of love, as we explained in the light. So the Gemara actually says, the removal of that ring did more good for the Jewish people than all of the Nevi'im and the Nevi'us. Why? Because that brought us to Tshuva, that brought us to Kabbalah HaTorah, that brought us to be Zoche, to a special revelation of the Shechina that we would not have had. So, the Sivas says the following pshat. He says, when most of us think about, what am I grateful for in Purim? Most of us say, I'm grateful that although Haman tried to destroy us, we were saved through the intervention of Mordechai and Esther. Meaning, I'm grateful for the redemption. But most people are not going to think, I'm grateful for Haman's decree. Haman's decree was the bad thing. I'm grateful that I was taken out of Haman's decree. In reality, however, one has to feel on Purim that I'm not only grateful for the salvation that HaKadosh Baruch Hu brought me, but in retrospect, I'm even grateful for this, not to Haman, but I'm even grateful to Hashem for putting me through the Sakana of Haman. Because it was the Sakana of Haman that brought me to tshuva. You see, because if you wouldn't be grateful for that, then you'd be happier if there was no gezeira of Haman. Let things be the way they were. But no, the gezeira of Haman forced me to change. So here's the pshat. A person must reach through drinking, but drinking is only the means to it. A person must reach a madrega of joy, where their joy and appreciation to the Eibishter is so great that they see no difference between the Yeshua that was brought through Mordechai, that's the Baruch Mordechai, and the redemption of tshuva that was brought through the Gezeira of Haman. That I'm grateful to Hashem not only for the Baruch Mordechai, but I'm grateful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the Oruah Haman. And in a more general sense,
like somebody could, I mean, there are people who live on that madriga all the time. They're grateful for it, right?
So but the answer
that
is,
doesn't seem to answer
every person.
The idea about
drinking and
giving up your das and all that.
Well, there are many other explanations. Mm-hmm. According to this explanation, the word lifsume is lav dafka referring to drinking so much as achieving a state of simcha. Drinking is a means. Now others say other things. Others say the following, that Purim is a time, as you know, which is called a hidden miracle. Because everything in Purim could be a series of coincidences. There was nothing supernatural in the story of Purim. Ahasuerus kills his queen. That's what they did. Ahasuerus picks another queen. That's what you do. It happened to be Esther. She happens to be in the right place in the right time. Mordechai happens to hear Bixen Veseresh trying to kill Ahasuerus. And remember, the story of Purim didn't happen like in 2 days. It happened over 11 years. So it was a slow process. So Purim is the prototype of what we call the hidden miracle. The Nes Nister. It's not an open miracle. It is hidden and concealed. In fact, Rav Futner says a beautiful thing. The Gemara in Megillah asks the question, why don't we recite Hallel on Purim? You know, we say Hallel on Hanukkah. Why don't we recite Hallel on the Yom Tov of Purim? So the Gemara says that is because reading the Megillah itself is a fulfillment of Hallel. Now, the Me'iri says, therefore, a law that says if you're on a desert island and you don't have a Megillah, but you have a sitter, let's say, you are supposed to say Hallel of the Bracha. Because Megillah takes the place of Hallel, but if you don't have a Megillah, you say Hallel. But we don't paskin like this Me'iri. We paskin, not only does Megillah take the place of Hallel, but Megillah is the only way you could do Hallel on Purim. In other words, Hallel is not good. Hallel is not a good Hallel on Purim. The only Hallel that's a good Hallel on Purim is Megillah, which, as you know, women have to hear as much as men. So Rav Huttner explains, why is it so that a substitute for Hallel should be better than the real Hallel? If Megillah is a substitute for Hallel, so Kal Vachomer, Hallel should be good. So Rav Huttner says the following idea. Hallel is expressing gratitude to Hashem for the miracle that He's done for us. So the type of Hallel that you have to say has to correspond to the type of miracle that you experience. Pesach, which is an open, obvious, supernatural miracle, requires a Hallel that is open and obvious. Thank you, Hashem, for splitting the Red Sea. But Purim, which is a hidden miracle in which everything could be chucked up to coincidence, and it's only a Nes Nister, requires a Hallel that is concealed and not obvious. Meaning, just like you don't say a hidden Hallel for an open miracle, you don't say an open Hallel for a hidden miracle. And therefore, the Hallel of Purim is Kriyas HaMegillah, in which, as you know, the name of HaKadosh Baruch Hu is not mentioned. You praise Hashem by indirection. So what turns out is the following. Everything in Purim is hidden. That's why the Gemara says, what is the remez in the Torah that there will be an Esther Hamalka? From a verse that says, Anochi Haster Astir Panai, I will hide my face. Hashem says this. The word Esther means hiddenness and concealment. It reminds us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu runs the world not only when it's obvious and miraculous, but even if life goes on day by day, minute by minute, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is there. We don't see Him, we don't sense Him, but He's there looking after us, taking care of us, running the world. Right? Purim, in a sense, has a very supreme importance because Purim reminds us of Hashgacha, not only when amazing things happen, but in the everyday life. And that's why Purim is connected to Gullus. Purim is our only Yom Tov that basically is a Gullus thing. It occurred between the two temples because Gullus is a Zman of Hester Panim. And Purim is the Hashgacha that exists in Hester Panim. In Hester Panim. So what turns out is the following. That's why you wear masks. That's why the minhag is to wear disguises on Purim. Because what does a disguise mean? A disguise, if I wear a disguise, I'm telling you, things are not what they appear to be. Appearances are deceiving. Appearances are non-real. Purim reminds us that the appearance of the world, that God is absent, is really a masquerade and an illusion. So some say the idea of drinking, another explanation is, that drinking is to go beyond our rationality. Our rational eyes give causes and effects to things that have nothing to do with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. If I were a political analyst, I could write a whole political discussion of how this happened without making reference to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Ahasuerus killed the queen because she defied him. He chose Esther because she had these qualities, etc. But you have to recognize that your seichel is not the guide for the reality of the world. To go beyond your seichel, to know there's a dimension of reality that you don't perceive with the mind. And that is the nascent of. So that would be another idea of going beyond. But on the other hand, that doesn't explain the Or Ham and the Baruch Mordechai.
No, but I can't piece the rest of it together, but has the Purim and Yom Kippurim, and then on Kippur, we give Hashem our hearts.
Yeah.
But that the higher level is to give our minds. Because even when we're given our hearts, we still think we're in control.
So, when we so give the drinking mind, is the total nullification to HaKadosh Baruch Hu by giving up your seichel.
Right, and we realize that we have nothing to do with it.
The surrender of the seichel says, I'm not in charge. Right. I am not in charge, I'm just a pawn that HaKadosh Baruch Hu moves wherever he wants. That's also very good, the idea of his spotless of the seichel. Although it's very interesting that Chazal say, you know, the gematria of yayin, the gematria of wine, is 60. And the gematria of secret, sod, is, yayin is 70, I'm sorry, and sod is 70. And this is the base of Chazal, nichnas yayin yatsa sod. When the wine comes in, when the 670 of the wine comes in, the confidentiality, all of your secrets come out. So the truth is, it can be very well documented, if you look at go to yeshiva or whatever it is, that a person's personality often emerges. Scary thing. Through intoxication. But you'll see, for example, people who are tzaddikim, when they get a little high on Purim, many beautiful things come out. All sorts of different Torah comes out, and Musar comes out, and Ashkafa comes out. The true person emerges when they don't have those restrictions. And Chas V'Shalom, if a person is not so good inside, that comes out as well. I'll tell you another thing, again, it's totally not relevant, but it's something that I was involved in recently, so it strikes me. It often happens this way too, even with illnesses like something like Alzheimer's, which is a really, really tragic illness, where a person's mind is destroyed. But often, what emerges is the fundamental inner personality of the person. It's very, very interesting. If a person was, let's say, a kind person, a nice person, a generous person, they may not even know who you are. You may be their daughter, you may be their son. And they don't know who you are, but they'll continue to behave based on that basic personality structure. It is embedded so deeply within them that remains. So here you also see the notion that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to be mevatel all of the barriers that we interpose, so the real self comes out. So anyway, I wish you all a freilich and a happy Purim. It should be a zman of geula, and we should all be zocha as we go towards Nisan, that it should be a month of Mashiach. So be sure to check back next week. I'll tell you all. Oh, okay. Kabbalah Shel Rebbe. Okay, thank you. Yeah, you know, we, it says in Pirkei Avos that if a person is learning Torah and they stop learning and they say, Ma noya ilon zeh, how beautiful is the tree, harei zeh mischayev benafshay, they're chayev misa, because they stop their learning to talk about how beautiful it is. So it would not be proper to talk about how beautiful it is, but there's a Hasidic interpretation that says that the reason the person is chayev misa is because they regard appreciating the beauty of nature as an interruption from their avodas Hashem, meaning they're mapsik. But if you regard the appreciation as part of being grateful to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, then for kids, it's not mischayev benafshel, it becomes a positive thing. So that's life. We're very fortunate in the middle of the winter to have such nice weather. It means Hashem should give us a karas hatayif to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for giving us a very comfortable environment. But be it as it may, we're still talking about the inyanim of Matan Torah, and I also want to connect a little bit to Purim and again to the Yom Tov of the Maral, interspersed with other machshavas. That is, there's a Gemara in Masechet Shabbos that says that a certain Galilean, a person from Galil, said to Rav Yaisi, "Baruch lach Amana, blessed is HaKadosh Baruch Hu."